When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Decade Project, the One Heat Minute Productions Patreon-exclusive podcast. I am, of course, your host, Blake Howard. Thank you so much for all of your support. This is where we go back exactly 10 years. It's going to be something that we keep doing, but right now, because we're in 2023, we're back in 2013, talking about a movie that this one is a funny one because it actually bridges the 2012-2013 gap, but I don't think actually any human being other than people in like international film festivals may have seen this bad boy in 2012, which is when it has this weird squirrely release date. It actually did hit theaters and major release in 2013. So I'm allowing the exception for the excuse to A, talk to my guests, but B, talk about the filmmakers and the stars of this movie. It is, of course, the kind of harrowing personal drama from Thomas Vinterberg and Mads Mikkelsen, The Hunt from 2013.
You wait for a long time?
Yes.
Der er vist noget galt her. Hvor er der, Pelle?
Lukas!
Hej.
Kigger du lige ind et øjeblik?
Hvad er det, der er sket?
Ja, det kan jeg ikke sige. Måske det bedste, at du tager fri et par dage, ikke? Så kan vi få det her på plads sådan stille og roligt. Hvad har hun nu fundet på, den lille bandit? Vi har desværre anledning til at tro, at der er sket grænseoverskridende adfærd imod.
Du skal ikke høre på, hvad de siger mig.
Hvad laver I her? Hvad sker der?
Hjem igen, Lukas.
Du kan ikke få noget her.
Jeg har ret til at købe ind her.
Jeg kan godt gå selv.
Det er min bedste vens datter, det ved du godt, ikke?
Jeg tror på børnene, Lukas. Jeg har altid gjort.
Hvis du har rørt min lille datter.
Hvis du eller hvad?
Så får du en kugle i panden.
You are not a sick person, are you?
Du har ikke gjort noget.
Hvorfor lå du min far?
Hvad er det, du forestiller dig at ske?
Det er dem, der er blevet syge i hovedet.
Vil du sige noget til mig? Det er en by, der har hørt på dig, mand.
My guest, I really love because in this game, all we have is who we are. And his takes, while I agree and disagree with him in equal measure, are spicy and he has integrity and he litigates the living daylights out of them. And for that, I love him. It's my friend, freelance film critic, writer extraordinaire, has a great Substack. We'll make sure we link you to it and point it to you in the notes of this bad boy. It's Noah Jatel. How are you, my friend?
I'm great. And after hearing you say all those nice things about me, I can honestly say I love you too, buddy.
Well, look, all we have is who we are, my friend. All we have is who we are, and you got to fight for it. And if you think something, I don't care how spicy your take is, if you can litigate it, it's all yours to have.
Well, you know, the truth is, many years ago when I was first starting out in film criticism, an established critic got in touch with me to offer me a couple words of praise. And what he said was, unlike some of your contemporaries, when I read your work, I always feel like there's a person behind it, yeah. A specific individual with strong opinions and feelings. And I've always kept that in mind and tried to keep that up as I go through this crazy world.
Honestly, that's I feel like, other than being a cinephile, like I love film criticism. and all of its myriad of forms. And when it becomes advertorial, teat sucking, studio sycophantic bullshit, I hate it. And when it's really rich and I can hear the voices, you know, my favorite living film critic is Manola Dargis. On a very short list after that are people like Walter Chaw, Sean Burns, my dear friend Katie Walsh, you know, Justin Chang, you name them. There's like fantastic film critics out there and writers. And I just love diving into their voices. And sometimes, again, as I said, I wildly disagree with lots of people, but I think so many people want to draw lines and put barriers between themselves. Very interestingly, on the topic we're going to be talking about today, but people want to put barriers up between themselves. And I just don't take anything personally, because I don't know if it's like, maybe it's more because like the mates that you hang out with, like in Australia, and sometimes I share this stuff when I talk about me, is my friends don't listen to all of my podcasts. Like, I mean, my dearest friend, Maria, she's heroic that she like supported and loves a lot of the stuff I do. She'll listen in and jump in and out when certain things interest her. But like my mates who I go to the pub with and watch sport, they don't know what I do. They don't know what I do, Noah. They don't care. And we argue about everything, movies, politics, TV, particularly sporting teams. Who's clueless? Why did you bet that? Why did you tell me to put money on that, you idiot, etc. And it's like, we love each other. It's like, I don't care. Like, think whatever you want to think. Like we can talk about it. It's fine.
No, it's great to have folks in your life who are not in the specific film, Twitter, cinephile world that we're in, for a number of reasons. Number one, it makes me a more well-rounded person. And yeah. Number two, it does help you know kind of where film culture stands in the real world. You know,
yes,
I mean,
yes.
When some of my friends come to me and say, so what do you think about Barbenheimer? Well, then I know, okay, this actually crossed over
it
to
crossed
normal
over.
People. Yeah. And that's a useful kind of barometer.
And yeah, like this year until, and in Sydney, we were sort of lucky because of the Sydney is a Mission Impossible city as much as we begrudge the movie that was set here. You might love or hate John Woo's Mission Impossible 2, but it's a mission city, right? Like just like James Bond has like Bond cities, you know, et cetera. And so when Tom Cruise came out, like people were talking about Dead Reckoning. Like it was a massive crossover. People talked about it. People have been talking about Barbie. People have been talking about Oppenheimer. Most of the rest of the year, not a peep. Nothing. And
no.
Maybe one or two people in like February going, have you seen that movie Everything Everywhere All at Once? And I'm like, yeah, really enjoyed it. Can I watch it somewhere? Yeah, it's on, you know, do you have a Blu-ray? Oh, no, I don't have, okay.
You know what? They talk about every crap TV show, don't they?
Oh, every damn one, Noah. I always give the same argument. How long is it?
Yeah. How many movies could you have watched?
Yeah, exactly. It's the math. Well, that's six movies. No way. Like I've got an education. There's hundreds of movies, of great movies, you know, canonically required viewing that I haven't seen, and I'm not giving it up to watch.
Oh, you and me are two peas in a pod, buddy. I'll tell you. I think about it the exact same way. I'm not going to get to them all before I die. I'm not going to waste time on a crap TV show.
No, never. And they're like, don't worry, you just got to watch three seasons and it'll catch you. Fuck off. It's not happening. It's absolutely not happening. But let's get to the topic at hand, because we're back in that weird borderlands between 2012 and 2013. And this was most certainly the first film that, not the first Mads film. I have to go back a little bit further with Mads to see where I'd spotted him first, but most certainly my first interaction with the filmmaker Thomas Vinterberg. And if you haven't seen the film, just to give you the sort of IMDb logline, it's about a teacher played by Mads Mikkelsen, who has just lost his job in what is probably like a primary school or the Danish equivalent of a primary school in a small town that seems to be sort of dwindling. You know, I think the one of the subtexts, or I guess the tapestry of this film, is just that thing that happens. You know, smaller towns that used to be booming, had booming industries, are shrinking, etc., in this sort of provincial part of Denmark. And while he's struggling to get custody over his son and trying to get his life back on track, he's clearly suffering from a divorce. He's looks like a total sweetheart, finds some new love. He's one of his students, a young girl, is exposed to some pretty dark sort of like pornography from a teenage brother, has a moment where her small and underdeveloped brain like mixes and muddles things. And then she says something that makes one of his colleagues suspicious. And then rather than, and obviously in the impossible circumstance of a young person like that saying that something happened to me, of course the town reacts as it should and as you would hope, which is that out of protection. And he becomes vilified in the town in a situation that he can't really defend himself. And it changes every relationship, friendship, work relationship. And he sort of goes through this incredible ordeal, and the family and his friends and the entire community channel it and go through it with him. And at the time, I remember, and really overall, when you have a look back at some of the criticism, I was doing some research in the last couple of weeks as we were doing it, checking out a bunch of old reviews, they were really moved. I think the things that really resonated at the time was that it was this searing psychological drama, but every character felt really deeply human. It didn't feel like archetypes or caricatures or doing things for the way that we're doing it. The conflict was like a rot through the town. And I think all of that still really plays. When did you see this, Noah?
I think I saw it right around the time it came out, maybe not in the theater, but probably shortly thereafter.
Yeah. I think it had a run in Australian indie cinemas at the time. And I would imagine in the States, it probably had something similar.
Yeah, I think so. And I was just getting into film criticism at the time when it came out. So I wasn't too familiar with Mads Mikkelsen. I think I'd seen him in Casino Royale probably, and yeah. Maybe that was it. But I already thought of him maybe just from that film, or maybe I knew his reputation as like, you know, a guy who played somewhat creepy guys.
Yeah.
And because Hannibal came out the same year. I think it started the same year, which I didn't watch because it's a TV show. But
that one I did watch only because I love Mads Mikkelsen. I was like, I'm going to give this a watch because it's Mads and I'm right in.
Are you glad you did?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Not all TV is like this. And I know that if you've got to do the currency, it's super hard, but I think in multiple years in a row, if we just fast forward to now, in 2020, so I saw, I think another round I saw in like 2020, and I think his next film, Riders of Justice, I saw in 2021. He made a few movies in that period. And I genuinely think that Thomas Vinterberg's Another Round, which we'll talk about a little bit later, is a stone cold masterpiece and absolutely eviscerates me. And it was especially at a time in my life when I was transitioning from one corporate job. I was getting into teaching as well as film criticism, etc. And then I watched Riders of Justice and I thought it was, again, one of these kind of Nordic movies that has these has pulpy pop elements in it, but has these deep, like absolutely cavernous portrayals of people that have got trauma. And just like really realistic, and the characters are just memorable and funny and rich and multi-layered. And so I remember, like, if you said, what are my favorite two movies of 2020 and 2021, they'd both star Mads Mikkelsen. So that's where I'm like, wow. He's my guy. Like, so that was the only reason why I sometimes take a dalliance. I'm like, if it's one of my guys, I will dip in.
Well, it's good to know. And if you were a normal person, I would, and you recommended Hannibal to me, I would say, okay, I'll go check it out. But I'm not going to lie to you. I probably still
won't. No, you won't. You won't. It's fine. Don't. You don't need to say that.
But So I remember being really bowled over by The Hunt the first time I saw it. And, you know, it is a gut-wrenching film, I think, in a lot of ways, because sorry, I don't know if you can hear my dog. She's awake and she's drinking water. I'm using a very good microphone. And the downside to that is you can hear every move my dog makes. But no, it's a gut-wrenching film. And I think, you know, it's one of those films that has such a powerful core idea that we can all very easily find our way into it.
Yes.
You know, it sounds stupid, but when I watch The Hunt, my way into it is I've been the subject of a Twitter pile-on.
Yes.
And I know what it feels like to have everyone think you're one thing, taking something out of context, whatever it is, and you know, no, that's not actually true. That's not what I am. And there's really no way for you to get out of it. Everything you do just sort of makes it worse. And that's exactly what this character goes through in the film.
Yes. And I was just going to say, you lean in, the further you lean in these circumstances, the worse that it gets. And this movie has every one of those impulses, like yes, trying to reason, logic, like talking about where he is. It's making people doubt their own memories of things, and memory is, in yeah, some instances, deeply unreliable. And it's like people start remembering the story they're telling themselves as the memory, and it's that mm-hmm, out of context. And then this movie just does it layer by layer by layer. And it just, the whole time you're in this position. I think that that's what's so great, at least from the way that it positions itself or its preliminary perspective, is that we at least know, the audience knows. I don't think there's ever a doubt for us. It's like, he didn't do this.
Mm-hmm.
But we get to see what happens, because it doesn't matter whether he did or whether he didn't do it or whatever context it was. It's just, this is now that it's there, this is what it is.
So I will say that on this viewing, I had some mixed feelings about that choice, to be perfectly honest with
yes,
you. Not necessarily that I wish Vinterberg had made us question whether he did it, but I do feel like the character of Lucas is purely a victim the entire time.
Yes.
And I didn't need them to question, you know, did he do this? But I would not have minded if they had him question, maybe I shouldn't have been alone with her as much as I was.
Yeah.
Maybe I did get too close to this family. Or maybe even some, this is what I would do if something like this happened to me, I would think, am I being karmically punished for some other choices I've made in my life, maybe with my ex-wife? You know, the film doesn't really allow us to see his divorce and what happened with the custody of his kid through any perspective but his own. And again, he's the victim in all yeah, of that. And there were moments during this watch when I wished it had broadened its scope a little bit, or that simply he as a character had been a little more introspective about what yeah, was happening to him.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of it like that, but it wouldn't have had to be a lot. It mm-hmm, wouldn't have had to be too much. It could have just been with a confidant of like, I should never walk alone. And like, what's weird, and this is my own personal perspective, is like, and I know this might sound strange, but male teachers, one of the first things that a senior mentor male teacher will tell you is like, do not be alone in a room with a female student by yourself at any, mm-hmm, even if you're doing tutoring, whatever, it's multiple students. You're never alone with, and if it's multiple female students, you're never alone. It's always a mix of boys and girls. It's just because, you know, number one, from a safety perspective and reputational perspective and all that other stuff, mm-hmm, there are some really disgusting people who find children attractive and would yeah, want to have their ego inflated and do all that disgusting stuff. So, and the other thing is just like, it's not done. And so like in every instance, like there'd be a time where like a student would go, can I come and see you? And you're like, yeah, sure. Like come see me at the staff room,
mm-hmm,
you know, where
mm-hmm,
my peers are.
Right.
You know,
make sure the door's open to the office, that sort of thing.
All that stuff. Like come to the staff room. The door's always open. There's always multiple teachers in there. Yeah. Come sit up. Yep. Have a chat or come sit out. There's sort of like a little waiting desk outside the door. Let's have a chat.
Is a stupid question, but I wonder if in Europe, like that kind of thing isn't as front and center in people's minds. I also wonder if even 10 years ago, that wasn't as front and center in people's minds as it is now.
Yeah. And also it's the other thing is male teachers in childcare, it's so rare. Like, it's so rare. Even male primary school teachers, like, you know, my daughter's primary school, there's a few male teachers. There's so many more just female teachers. It just is what it is. I don't know what the makeup is or the trust gap is, but it just seems that like, you know, younger child education, it's just like more like that. So it's just interesting that maybe that was a shift of perspective, or maybe it's a different thing for Denmark. They've got a different sort of makeup, but in Australia, specifically, yeah, absolutely. It would be, if there was a male childcare worker, it would be like, huh, like I can't help. And I just watched The Hunt and I just was praising it for its, I can't help but be the guy that's like, huh, yeah, what are you doing here? Like my kids.
And yet there didn't seem to be any of that before the incident. Nobody yes. seemed to question him. They seemed to think he was, especially because he was single. I mean, he was divorced, but still he was a single man in the school. You know, and I guess he did have a little hesitance before walking the little girl to school and spending that alone time with her. But they also demonstrate that he was very close friends with her father. So it wasn't like she was just a normal kid. He was a friend of the family, which probably assuaged any concerns he would have had about being alone with her.
And I think that's the line. If it's mm-hmm. any other kid except like one of his best mates' stepdaughters or something like that, he goes to their house all the day, he carries her father, stepfather home, drunken all the time. They spend a lot of time together. He knows exactly where she is. She knows him and the dog. It's like, you don't even think about that. And I also think about that too. Like with, you know, I've got, you know, some of my closest friends, if I saw their kid on the street, like, especially because we live sort of close to each other, I'd be like, what are you doing? I wouldn't even hesitate. I'd call my wife and be like, I just found so-and-so.
Yeah, of course. Straight,
I'm walking them home because I don't want anything to happen to them. And so that's, I think, also that other moment of like, especially in that buildup of like, you just wouldn't think, if it was a friend's kid, you wouldn't think twice.
And that's consistent throughout the film. I think there aren't too many choices he makes that you can really point out and say, that's the wrong choice.
Yeah.
You know, everything he does is at the very least understandable. And that's what makes it so gut-wrenching. I mean, there's no place where he really steps out of line. He has emotional reactions to things, sure, that maybe were not the smartest in retrospect, like getting his ass kicked in the supermarket, you know, just for fun, essentially. But there's not too many things he does.
That scene kills me.
It's brutal.
And a small town, he just like lets himself get beaten up, and then he has a visceral reaction where he goes and has to react. Because he's forcing himself not to react the whole time. And then he has to be something. And it's just like, that's, I think Vinterberg here with the unflinching gaze at real tactile, unembellished violence mm-hmm. gets me. Because in every movie we watch, we love it. Like, I've got a Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning poster behind me. I love it. Like, give me an explosion. Give me a motorcycle. Give me beautiful staged action, choreographed fight scenes. But there's something about when movies actually depict real violence in its very tactile way, very straight-faced, not much mustard on it to give it any sort of enhancement, just that you go, God, just someone throwing a can, it's gonna dent someone's skull. Like, that's enough.
It's very powerful in the film because there's been such a long buildup to it. You know, yes. I mean, this is a film in which it feels violent almost the entire way through. You know, Mads Mikkelsen is a cauldron of controlled rage, I think, throughout the film. And he has these little moments when he kicks his girlfriend out of the house, where it's like, well, that was actually like, that's a little much, you know, that's not cool. His son acts on his behalf and spits in this girl's face, but he can't express himself the way he wants to express himself because he knows it's just going to get him in deeper. It's just going to hurt his case. Oh, not only is he a pedophile, he's full of violent rage as well. So when it does happen in those moments, it's done by Vinterberg very purposefully, I think, and for maximum impact.
Yeah. And I think that's you touched on that great thing about, and I agree, there could definitely have been more space for introspection. But the one thing that I push back on for me is that when I know why his wife's not with him, Like, I feel like that I'm having an emotional reaction, and maybe there's some sense, regardless of the situation, that people go interior. You know, you probably have this, you know, in your work life, social life. Like, I find that sometimes when there's hugely stressful situations, some people are really big. They get big. The higher the stress, the bigger it is. And I'm a little bit more like a Mads. Like, the more the stress, I'm just like, just comes back in and it's focused. Like, I'm not going to yell about it. I'd rather yell about something important, like sport or a movie. But when it's like a real stressful situation and there's like lots going on, it's like, okay, I try and bring it, be really small and bring it into, you know, crystal clarity and break it down into component parts and go, okay, this stress is here. But so you can see that with him, his instant, I guess, stress reflex is like cut people off.
I see your point. Out. Yeah. Well, and there's multiple, and he does it to everyone. You know, he does it to someone weaker than him. He does it to someone bigger than him and stronger than him, whatever it is, whoever he's up against, he has that reaction. Mm-hmm. And I think it's there in the central metaphor of the film as well. You know, the killing of these deer, this tribal ritual that they have, the violence is embedded. He seems like a nice, sweet guy in a lot of ways, but violence is in there and it's in every man in this community.
Yes. Yeah. That's spot on. So my first Mads, if we go back to the first time I seen him, he was right around this time, but I saw him, I think, in Pusher, and it would have been about 2000. Like, so he was then in Nicholas Winding Refn's the Pusher trilogy, but I think I saw him in Pusher. I think I saw him in Pusher. I want to say 2004, maybe. It came out in 96. So I saw it like nearly a decade after it had been released. And it was one of those kind of like international movies that a friend had a DVD of and was like, oh, this movie's sick, you know. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. That was exactly how it was sold to me. And then I didn't really see him until, like, again, other random sort of Hollywood movies. He pops up in King Arthur from 2004, and then obviously massive gigantic breakout is Casino Royale, and I think everyone saw him by then. And then he becomes, I guess, part of pop culture in a big way. And then he's still making a lot of international films, but then he starts to pop up in other things. So he, you know, makes this, he's in Doctor Strange, he's in Star Wars Rogue One, etc. So now that we come to now, at the time, I think this movie now just looks like
can I mention my favorite Mikkelsen performance?
Oh yes,
which you glossed over because I don't know many people who've seen this movie, but I absolutely love it, and it's called Men and Chicken.
Oh my God, I think I have seen this movie.
It's another Danish movie, and he and another man, they play brothers, very strange men, who their father dies and tells them in his will that they're adopted, and they go to this remote island where a scientist who is their real father is conducting very strange experiments involving chickens. And I don't want to say too much. I don't want to spoil the wonderful surprises of this film, but it is truly perverse and truly wonderful. And Mikkelsen's performance is very rich and layered, and the full depth of it is not revealed until the end. And it's just, I think, remarkable.
Oh, that's so fun. And look, in 2015, it's, by the sounds of things, he did two of his best performances, Men and Chicken, and in Rihanna's Bitch Better Have My Money film clip, which made him iconic. And I want to just call that out because, like, that's
what a year.
That's a year. That's a year.
Something for everybody.
literally, some batshit independent movie with son of a mad scientist, and Rihanna's Bitch Better Have My Money. And he's such, I think now, like 10 years later, Mads Mikkelsen is so memeable. He's so beloved. And even from the Bitch Better Have My Money, like, someone's like, oh, you're in that Rihanna's film clip. He goes, yeah, I'm the bitch. Like, he's just, he has a hilarious, dry sense of humor. He's very funny. And I think because it's almost 10 years, you know, it was like about 7-8 years between drinks. He his latest movie with Thomas Vinterberg, Another Round, I truly think it's like, if I was making one of those, and I hate list making just in general, but if I was making a best of the decade list, that's in the top two or three, and you're hard pressed. It's going to be a tough hang to try and break Another Round out of that list. You know, there's going to have to be some pretty gargantuan films that I come across for me to even think about it. But so I think in 10 years, all we've seen is that Mads Mikkelsen is easily one of the most accomplished and versatile actors we've seen come out of Europe in the last 20 years. And he can do everything: comedy, drama, big, dumb Hollywood fare, really quirky independent movies, video games. Like, he could do anything. I think if there's one lesson from this, it's Mads.
Mads rules. He really has mastered the one for them, one for me kind of thing. Because he does one for them, I mean, he makes it count. He does these huge franchises with beloved, devoted fan bases. And then when he does the one for him, it's you know, European film. It's with people that he loves and respects. And Another Round, I think is great. I don't know that I have it quite as high as you on my list, but I think it's great. And
I did study to be and was a teacher for a little bit. So it hits on a frequency for me.
And you have mentioned going to the bar several times in this conversation as well. Yeah. So that's up your alley. But it's interesting because it's about a lot of the same things as The Hunt, or it's about this kind of male camaraderie. It's about this community. It's about, it's about masculinity in many, many ways, even though tonally it's such a different film. So these guys really have a lane that they work well in, I think.
Yeah, they seem to work hand in glove. And I also love that you talk about the male camaraderie of it all, and with Another Round, I just love that they're all seeking. It's all the bad ideas that you have had when, you know, you do go to the bar, and that's what I mean. The whole movie is this one big bad enduring idea, and usually when the alcohol wears off, your clear thinking brain comes back, and you can go, "What was I thinking? That was so stupid." And this movie just seems to have this unrelenting, like, they just continue to pour a little fuel on that fire, so every bad idea is there, but it's this aching desire to feel something. There's this kind of numbed experience collectively with all of these guys, and they're all holding traumatic experiences, failure, you know, self-doubt, and I think that that's what's particularly nuanced in The Hunt, and like is more refined and sweet and a little bit melancholic in Another Round. But in The Hunt, it's like all these, the character that Mads is playing in The Hunt, the lead character of the film, is I just want to get his name, Lucas, his existence and the posing of the question that he could be this sort of sinister predatory figure is so beautifully reflected in everyone's doubts about themselves in all the men in town. Like, they all of their protector instincts are called into question. It's another great layer of that movie. And so I think that that's what Vinterberg does really well. Like, actually, I love these kind of more rich examinations of masculinity in his films. They just seem to really resonate with me. And I love that, because then everyone starts looking at themselves like, oh my God, I've done something wrong. I failed. I failed my child. I failed our community. I failed not to see. I let this person in. All those doubts.
You really see it in the performance of the guy who plays his friend, the father of the girl.
Yeah. I think it's Theo. His name's Thomas Bo Larsen.
Right, and he's a Vinterberg regular as well. He's in Another Round, I think, and because he's very open to listening to him and hearing him at first. Although the first scene is quite interesting, where he ignores his wife's wishes and they eat that cake or pie together, just completely ignores her instructions gleefully, and then when Lucas comes to his house, you know, he brings him in. He's willing to listen. He's willing to talk. He's clearly conflicted. But it's when his wife comes home and says, "What is this man doing in our house?" that he completely changes and goes completely to the other side and throws him up against the wall and says, "Get the hell out of my house," whatever he says. So I think it's the reflection of his failures, you know, in his wife's eyes, maybe even feeling subservient to his wife in some ways, or inferior to her, that he has to step up and do this show of masculinity, this protective father thing that he's not entirely sure he is or that he wants to be. But in the face of that, he has no choice but to embody that. Yes. And it's only a couple scenes, but it's really skillfully drawn, I think.
Yeah, he's so easy to write off early in the movie. I love some of these great European character actors because they just have that ability to play like dopey, you know, kind of a little bit behind the step. They're not quite as the sharpest tack, you know, whatever you want to say, but they just feel like they're a little bit dim. And then when he sharpens into focus and like he turns it on in this movie, you're like, oh man, he's very skilled. Like this guy really knows what he's doing. He's drawing us in, and Vinterberg working with him. They're just pacing it out for it. And then even further, like more devastatingly, is like the church scene, which I can't get enough of.
No, the whole scene happens in his face, in his eyes, you know. Yep. There's almost no dialogue in that scene. But it's a turning point of the film, really, when he realizes what he's done. He accepts the beating. I like that in movies when a character is getting slapped or hit and they know they deserve it, and they just let it happen. That's always a powerful moment in a movie. I remember for some reason in the Mel Gibson movie Ransom, when he thinks he's killed his daughter, and his wife just slaps him in the face and he just sits there and takes it. And that moment for some reason always resonates with me. And this is a really good example of it. When he throws, I guess it's the Bible he throws at him, and he just sits there and takes it. It's so strong and so powerful.
Yeah. And what's funny is the maelstrom of emotion around him, and he's just dead. Yeah. You know, he's like dead. He's just like, such amazing choices and performances there.
He's the only one in the community we really see being contrite at all in the entire movie, you know, because at the end, all is forgiven except for the mysterious man with the rifle, whose face we don't see at the end. But, you know, everyone else just tries to move past this. And that's the only moment really of contrition that we see in the entire film. And it's a hell of a performance.
Let's talk about that moment. That moment I've never forgotten. I think if there's one moment in the whole of Hunt, you know, is, you know, despite all the violence, it's because I've never been able to place whether he sees a man there or what that means, or, you know, and I'm down for any and all readings of it, right? Like if you came to me and said it was a man, or if you came to me and said it was a vision, or whatever the case may be, like that ongoing sort of psychological persecution of that impact of that event, or it was like literal, it was someone taking a pot shot at him because, you know, they still harbor like a grudge and they feel like he was actually, you know, guilty of this, you know, horrendous act that he was accused of. But man, I love that scene. It's just so special because again, it just sets it up for this quiet, and it's like solitude and it's like peace and it's like, oh, we're coming back. And you just know, I think from the second I was watching it the first time, I was like, oh, this is not safe. This doesn't feel tranquil. This doesn't feel like it's a moment where he's going to go and kill an animal and then eat the meat, you know, and share it and take it home to his family or friends and community. It doesn't feel like it did in the beginning of the movie. It feels empty, vacant, death.
Yeah. You know, it's hard for me sometimes because I'm sort of an animal rights guy. And when I see people hunt, when I see people hunting, like there's no part of me that doesn't feel there's something sinister going on in that. So when I see them, you know, celebrating this teenager's first rifle, and I see the end of the world happening, you know, I'm like, this is how we end this kind of shit. But I don't think that's the film's intent exactly. I mean, I do think they're linking, you know, the violence, obviously.
I think that's not subtext. That's the text. It's like, oh, cool. More violence. More violence is what this community needs. I think that's a decent reading.
Yeah. That's fair. But I also think the moment at the end, it's a testament to the film that any of those readings are valid at the end of the movie. They really are. The idea that it's all in his head and this man isn't even there, that's valid because we've been in his head the entire time, pretty much. The idea that somebody is actually still harboring a grudge is valid as well, because the movie has very skillfully demonstrated what a threat just this idea is to the whole community. So I think it's, I just think it's a real testament. And it, you know, when a movie nails its final shot like that, and it makes you appreciate all that has come before, there's just nothing like it. And that's what takes a movie from good to great in many cases.
Yeah. The final shot where it's just all living in his face and you're, and I think exactly his expression is the question mark. Was this real? Almost. And you're like, yeah, this is, I understand. I rewatching it again, preparing to talk to you, I was like, oh yeah, I understand why this is one that maybe not many people would, because of just the, like the log line subject matter, you would be, you would have less of an inclination to go back and revisit, but there's so much other stuff going on here about communities and about those experiences as you're talking about these pylons and this stuff. It's so rare, honestly, when I see a pylon, and you've suffered one as you were talking about earlier, when I see a pylon with a man, I'm like, isn't this only reserved for women on Twitter? Like my friends who say the most banal opinion or just normal thing, and then they get piled on by a bunch of idiots. I'm like, they just had a take. It was not like so inoffensive. My best friend, Maria Lewis, is a great screenwriter and author. And I remember she wrote, Noah, genuinely, I'll try and send you the link. It's a fantastic criticism of Joaquin Phoenix's Joker, saying that he wasn't very good at doing makeup. It was a satire piece about he wasn't good at dyeing hair. I don't believe his hair color would be that good. His contouring is bad. It was just, it was purely farce, very fun read. If you're a girl who reads fashion blogs, my friend just literally lift and dropped all of the tropes of a fashion blog criticism of like a famous celebrity's makeup and hair and applied it to Joaquin Phoenix as the Joker.
That is so sophisticated, far too sophisticated for Twitter.
So when she shared it, the like hate tweets, hate what, I was like, this is a joke. It's a, it's in a post, it's designed as a joke. It's not even talking about the quality of the movie. It's talking about the character. I don't believe this guy could dye his hair that good. Look, he didn't even get dye on his upper forehead. You know, like that sort of shit. And that's what I think with some of these pylons, it is like,
yeah,
it becomes this, I don't know, like this weird momentum tribal instinct thing that happens. And whether or not I, like, I just don't, it, the other impulse is sometimes just like, if you just don't care, if you don't agree, like Twitter is not the best place for discourse, but if you don't agree, it's like, okay to go, no. And like, it's so very rare that you, if someone has articulated a long form opinion, to just not go, okay, whatever.
Yeah. You know, that's the thing. If somebody does sort of a shrugged off snarky tweet and they get piled on, and that's happened to me.
Yeah.
I get it, because they're meeting my level of effort with their own level of effort. You know,
if you meet your level of effort and my level of effort and ours is a bullshit snarky tweet, it's just fine. We came to this party together, but if I've written a novel and you come back with like a shitty out of context, one quote thing, it's like, well, that's not what it is. There's 100,000 words there. So yeah, I completely agree. If you meet my shitty off throw off tweet with shitty off throw tweets, it's like, fine, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I don't deserve, you know, 1,000 shitty tweets in response to it, but and you know, but it happens, and that you have to do some sort of, I mean, I guess this is what I'm talking about with the film. In that case, I would do some introspection and say, hey, maybe that wasn't the best tweet.
Deleting now, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which I have done. And then they find old versions of it and share them anyway. Yes, with a longer, more thought out piece, they certainly deserve, you know, a close read, a fair read. And people don't get, women especially do not get that.
Oh my God. Yeah, no, that's what I'm, it's just, it happens all the time. I see my co-host Katie Walsh on Am I Mean Our Show. Like Katie sometimes, she just goes, deleted that tweet.
She gets filmmakers writing her into their movies too, so that's a whole other level.
And you, I can't imagine being that petty. You know,
I don't know Katie, but and I don't know what that would feel like, but there's part of me that thinks it is the ultimate compliment.
I think in some instances it could be, but it's also like, oh, then this is the only other thing that I would say that it's tired. No, because it's like, if it's a bad, if you pan a film and you own it, like you own it, Katie has great integrity, you know, great critics, they'll just, if they don't like it and they clearly articulate why they don't, they'll pan the living shit out of it. Even if people are praising something to high heaven, if you detest it and can clearly articulate it, I personally think as a person who deep dives on a lot of movies and filmmakers, and I sort of stay in, I wouldn't say stay in my lane, but like I have a wheelhouse and I get really fascinated, I am enriched by all criticism. If even if it is panning the living shit out of something that I love, if it's well articulated, I'm ride or die. It's like even the, you know, people call him like crazy, like Armand White, who has some of the weirdest takes I think I've ever read. Man, he writes well. Like, yeah. I just don't think anyone could say that he doesn't write brilliantly. Like he's a really deft writer. Does his math sometimes like 2 + 2 = 5? And I'm like, what? Like, how did you draw that conclusion from that beautifully articulated series of kind of analysis? Sure, but it doesn't ever lose. And so I think if you're going to ride or die and go, yeah, they're going to comment on me, I think the problem is, and this is where I would think that it would get so tiresome, is that then everyone notices that. And then you've got to deal with people, other reviewers and critics reviewing that thing and then having an opinion about him mentioning that person in there. It's just like, then it becomes this like snake eating its tail, self-perpetuating cycle of like dialogue. And you're like, I didn't even like the guy's last movie. I don't care. I don't care. I want to move on. I want to go watch Miami Vice again. Bless her heart. But yeah, it's one of those things that it must be tough.
It's tough. I mean, and I don't know what it feels like to have my work seriously reviewed, you know, seriously picked apart. And it must not feel good. But, you know, I've spoken with some creators privately about the role of critics and had some very constructive conversations with them. But they never seem to get the benefit. They never seem to remember, you know, hey, you've had a moment in your career where critics have lifted you up as well. And I wish they would, because that's the whole thing. The whole thing is that we call it like it is, and you are elevated by that and you get diminished by that sometimes too. But the good stuff never seems to stick with them as much as the bad stuff does. Maybe that's human nature.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it's a hard thing because of the whole, like with the globalization of media and stuff like that, it's hard to realize the profound impact that certain criticism in certain channels used to have. Mm-hmm. And still some to a certain extent still does. And I think that, you know, in some of the, you know, freelancing that you do for some of those bigger publications, if you write something really glowing about a film, it can get a lot of eyes on it, and people have big audiences, and you know, and I'm very candid when things work or don't work for me on the show, and I try not to peddle too much. I think a clue for most people is if I don't talk about it, if I watch it and I don't talk about it, it's a pretty big signal that it really did nothing for me. It didn't resonate, and I think that that's the only thing that I can say for myself. It doesn't resonate with me in any way. If it does, you're going to hear about it, right? Yeah. But I was watching, I know this is like a weird tangent, but I really love Jon Favreau's movie Chef, and particularly also love, because I love cooking, I love his show with Roy Choi, The Chef Show. And they did a spectacular episode, and I think I've watched it about 20 times, about Jonathan Gold, the famous LA food critic. And they praised him because he'd passed, and they sort of eulogized him in this beautiful episode, because Roy and there was another great Thai chef in there had talked about how found the impact on his review of their little startup, whether it's a food truck, their little Kogi truck review, their, you know, this little Thai restaurant in LA said it was the most exciting Thai food in town. They were profoundly impactful for them. And I think The Chef is a great movie that talks, you know, it's really talking about cinema. It's all about kitchens, but it's really talking about cinema and the profound positive impact that critics can have and the negative impact. And then that dialogue between critic and creator. So really great. But I just remember, I remember that show particularly as one of the first times that, like, I loved this critic. They did everything for me. And I'm so grateful that they gave me that opportunity, that platform. And then that my life changed.
Yeah. You don't hear it much. I guess when Roger Ebert died, we heard from a number of filmmakers, Remy and Barani, and people like that, whose careers really were helped by his championing of them. But there aren't that many critics who have that kind of power, fewer than ever, I think.
Fewer just than ever.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Chef, because I don't know that show. I'm not a huge cooking guy, but I do love Chef. And I have tweeted about this before. I may have written about it somewhere. It's the best portrayal of a critic, I think, ever in a movie.
Yes.
Because it starts out, you think he's just an asshole because you're on Favreau's side. But it is revealed over the course of the film, and particularly in the final scene, I think, that this is a person who wants the best from food. And, yeah, you know, subtextually from film. And he explains himself so well. He's like, how could I have given you a good review when you were serving that shit? And Favreau's character knew it was shit. And it's a really generous, because everyone assumes that that movie was made in the wake of like Cowboys and Aliens, which was a huge flop and critics hated it. So the take on that movie was that Favreau was saying, look at these awful critics who ruined my career. But they completely missed the reverse at the end, where he generously says, basically, they were right. You know, the movie was crap, and I'm better for having heard that.
And the whole movie is an acceptance of they were right. Like, I feel like the chorus, you know, some critics are better than others, but the chorus was that these movies were not to the standard that, like, people were championing me. Like, when Made and, you know,
Swingers
and all this stuff in his early career, that he's gliding up, and then he does Iron Man, which is, you know, fantastic piece of pop entertainment. It's awesome. Like, and so watching him go to that and then having the dip, the drop off, and then he's like, to reorient himself, went back, made a deeply personal movie, called in favors with the most expensive movie star in the world, who's just a buddy who like walks on set for a day, don't pay me, it's fine. And like has this amazing cast, Oliver Platt, I think the best, you know, if we can have a hero.
I love him.
He's amazing. But yeah, I think that's the, you know, that's that story. That's the flip, if you like, on that. But yeah, look, it's really small. Like in Australia, we used to have a movie show, like our kind of version of Siskel and Ebert, with David and Margaret. And Margaret was a former film producer. She wasn't a traditional film critic when she started. Now she's absolutely like one of our icons in film criticism. And they had their TV show. Margaret was more like sort of like a pixie and really funny and great and enjoyed performances. And David was like a really stuffed shirt, you know, really, you know, not a very kind of hated, didn't like genre cinema, more of an art cinema guy, et cetera. Like very stuffy, very rarely. And they just argue. They had that great Siskel and Ebert energy of like, they just argue with each other and their two personalities are so different. It was wonderful. But like since then, there's like no single film critic in this country that could hold a candle to either of them.
Yeah. There's more critics than ever. And they seem to have less power than ever.
Yeah.
I don't know what the solution is. And I know it's a hot topic. With that piece in The Guardian the other day, I know there's strong reason to have more critics than we used to, but definitely something has been lost along the way, I think.
Yeah. I have always thought, and particularly in the context, I don't know if I've ever talked about this on a podcast, but we had their show at the movies, or the movie show. It had a couple of iterations in this country. And they finished it because they didn't want to do it anymore. And I personally think that was the stupidest fucking idea that they could have done. They should have done what RogerEbert.com did, which I deeply respect, because it was Roger's site with a cup. And as his profile was immense and he was no longer writing, you know, or doing the show, and, you know, he was writing more and more. It's like they curated into this great cohort, very diverse, awesome cohort of people that write about a whole bunch of different kinds of topics and things like that. And he kind of, at least for a time there, had his fingerprints on mentoring those key people who he'd sort of anointed as the key critics on the site. And I've always thought, and both of those critics in Australia are alive, I've always thought, like, they should have had that show forever. And if they didn't want to do it every week, then they should have subbed in new voices, new critics. And it just could have kept going. It rated the freaking pants off. They still would have been the most powerful film critic entity there. Had some more reporters, had some other things, done little breakout podcasts. They could have had an industry in and of themselves on a major show, and then a platform for people to write, and they could have curated and been like senior editors. And then if they eventually wanted to retire, they could have like come on for the two or three shows a year or whatever the case may be, but they're still working. And I'm just like, this just seems really dumb and short-sighted. It's cool that they stepped away, but you left a vacuum in a platform that you could have helped to anoint the next generation.
When was that they stepped away from it, just out of curiosity?
It was about 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at that time we knew things weren't going well, you know, and that the power that comes with their brand would be hard to recreate. So yeah, it's a shame that they let that go.
It's a shame. I wish, you know, there's only, I just think, man, you could have just had them and then introduced different kinds of critics. It would have been great.
Well, I'm sorry, but Blake, you're carrying the load now. I mean, you're the one doing it down there.
Well, yeah, look, I, the other thing that I am kind of lucky with Noah is that in the orchestra of film criticism that seems to grow, but like in the orchestra of film criticism in the world, I know exactly where I am. I'm up the back, just hammering away, probably on a recorder, maybe a triangle, maybe some cymbals. But that's where I know exactly where I am in the orchestra. But that's one thing that I'm particularly passionate about is like, you're never going to hear me love a movie because I feel like I need to stay in people's good graces. Just never going to happen. And if they canceled me on every list and said, we're never inviting you to a screening again, I'd go, congratulations, you can't cancel my bank account because I can go and buy for every movie I want to go and see. I want to go to the theater and see it myself, whatever the case may be. And so like, I think that that's another thing when you first start out, you don't want to upset people because they're giving you access. And I think that that creates a really bad behavior because sometimes you feel like you can't be honest or you can't be candid. And you know, you have to file certain things, and, you know, if 80% of people like something, they need the spicy 20%. And if 80% of people hate something, they want the kind of sometimes bent, you know, really overly effusive, everyone else is wrong thing. And it's just like, it's
and I think for young critics especially, you know, they want to please the publicists. They also want to please the more established critics because we're all sitting on this community board together sharing our takes. And it takes some guts to step out of line and say, this thing that everybody else likes, I don't like, or this thing that everybody else thinks is garbage, I think has value. So the people who have independent, who are real independent voices, those are the most valuable people. And there is nothing that excites me more than loving a movie, going onto Twitter and seeing, like, you know, Bilge Ibiri panned it or something like that. I can't wait to read that piece, you know, even though I know he's going to make smart points and I'm going to be smarter by the end of it.
It's the same with me. It's like, I'll see a Jerry Butler movie on Amazon Prime. And I'm always like, Jerry is like, Katie loves Jerry. Bilge loves Jerry. I'm like, what did Bilge say? And I could think, Noah, that like, it didn't even keep me occupied while I'm ironing. You know, and then I go find Bilge and he's like, yes, amazing. And I'm like, fucking love you, Bilge. Yes, I'm going to read the shit out of this. I can't wait. And it's just, I feel like excited. I'm like, oh,
yeah.
And that's the other trick. Your favorite film critics in the world, what was so cool about them when there were less of us is that you knew if they just hated an actor, or they didn't jive with the filmmaker, so that sometimes they'd be like, I don't jive with this, right? I don't jive with his thing. And they would try and be very eloquently unpack the ways that doesn't jive with them. but you used to get to know them. So you're like, oh, it's a, you know, they might go, oh, it's a Scorsese movie. This film, my guy doesn't like Scorsese. And so if he says it sucks, you're like, oh, I love Scorsese. So if he says it sucks, I must love it. That's great.
Yeah. And or even in entire genres, you know, yeah. I mean, Ebert was quite famously like, he didn't get raunchy comedies like at all. There wasn't many that are classics today. He panned them. And I still tell people that when people talk about Rotten Tomatoes, I say, you know, forget Rotten Tomatoes. Just learn a critic who learn a critic. Like, you can like them or dislike them, but learn a critic. The truth is, it's hard. It's hard to even like pick one out because there's so many of us right now. So I do sympathize that that's harder to do than it used to be.
Yeah. But once you find someone that you jive with, mm-hmm. you know, and you feel aligned with them on most things, then I would encourage lean into the ones where you don't.
Yeah.
Definitely. Lean into those. They're good. That's good area because it's like, where am I growing? Where can I grow? Like, I personally, this is why I love talking to people like you. And this is why I do my show. And I'm so passionate about having so many different voices on the show who have so many wildly different opinions, is because I want to be enriched by new perspectives. And that's how I feel like I get better at what I do, is because I can try and adopt it, or like be enriched by a new read. Like, I'm like, oh, that's a good, oh, I like that. I like that read that I never heard before. But yeah, look, thank you for turning this great topic of chat about The Hunt into like actually, no, the overarching thematic sort of concerns of the movie. Yeah. I think what we've learned is that this movie's application as like a fable, you know, it was a very specific, hyper-specific thing. But now when you read it, it's like, it makes you want to talk about this stuff. It makes you want to talk about us and culture and the way that this happens. And like all these straight-faced people, you know, patting themselves on the back for being so loving of like Lizzo recently, are like, what does it say about us that we supported Lizzo? It's like, you didn't know that she was doing that shit.
Right.
You didn't know. Like, what are you going to do? You're like, okay, you can't cancel liking a person for how they posture. Maybe just question when someone's posturing a certain way that they might not be the nicest person you've ever met. It's like, so stupid. I'm like, are we adults? I saw a really serious journalist on a podcast talking about the other day. I was like, why are you talking about this? You're so much smarter than this conversation. Don't waste your time. So I think what I want to thank you is perfect person to talk about this perfect topic with, because I think that what we've learned is Mads rules. Vinterberg makes really great movies about masculinity and community, and that this is definitely worth a rewatch, and that this movie is now like a cultural fable in 2023 in a way that it probably never would be appreciated at the time.
Absolutely. And I'm glad this conversation went where it did, because I was afraid we were going to end up talking about Woody Allen. And this is way better than that.
Good. I was not going there. There's enough material on Woody Allen that we don't need to go there. Noah, thank you so much. I'll make sure I point everyone out to your Substack. And I think we maybe have one more of these in us before the year's out, because you're working on a book right now. Do you want to just give that a shout out so that we can line up our next chat?
Yeah, that'd be great. I've turned in this book. It's coming out next year. It's about baseball cinema, really. Like, and I love baseball. I love baseball movies. And this is an attempt to take the genre seriously and hopefully appeal to people beyond just people who love movies, but, you know, people who love baseball and maybe haven't thought that critically about films the way that we do. And it's coming out next spring at some point. And in the meantime, there is a 2013 film, a very good baseball film called 42, right, that maybe, I guess, you and I are going to discuss later this year.
Yes, let's do that. Awesome. I can't wait. And that talk about something that cuts through. In Australia, we are extremely envious of the ability for American cinema to have a baseball genre, because we don't have like, I always talk about, we've got our biggest sports in the country, cricket and probably rugby league. The two of the biggest, just for a population, you know, we're a weird regional country. There's certain sports that are more popular in parts of the country than others. But we're like, where's our Bull Durham, you know, for cricket? Yeah. Where's our X? Insert whatever great, amazing baseball movie for like a cricket, where's our version of that? And there feels like there's stories, and like all of the stories we make are just these ghastly biopics with shit wigs and bad makeup and awful for cinematography. But no, I'm really looking forward to reading. There are some amazing baseball movies.
And maybe Australia has one in them, because I did watch Australia in the World Baseball Classic this year. And I don't know if that would be a movie they didn't get too far, but maybe next time in a few years, they're going to do it again. So maybe that'll be Australia's shining baseball moment, worthy of being immortalized on screen.
I would love that. I would love that. I would love if that actually could happen. But yeah, no, sports movies in general, but specifically baseball. Excited to read it. We'll wrap up now, but we'll definitely do 42 because, you know, one thing we have learned about that is the impact of Chadwick, the impact in 2023 and the long shadow cast. So still very relevant for us to talk about, but thank you so much, my man, for doing this. I really appreciate it.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks, Blake.
And it feels like such a 20th century movie. It feels like something David Lean would have done or tried to do when he still had that kind of currency. And even then, he might not have succeeded.
It's incredible because, like, if you don't have time to watch all five seasons of Lost, you can just watch Fearless.
Not a week goes by that I don't think of the ending of Gallipoli. It's left a mark. A Year of Living Dangerously. You know, and then something like Last Wave, even, that's so deeply embedded with the land and the story of the land, the story of place. You know, I don't know that I'd seen very many movies at that point in my life that had such a down ending, and they had such a, you know, sort of strong sense of folklore attached to it as that. And something always so poetic and lyrical about Peter Weir's work.
Gallipoli was the first movie that ever traumatized me, and I don't think I ever really recovered from it. And I'm still upset that they played it in school. Like, I don't think it's actually possible to make an... They say it's not possible to make an anti-war movie, but I think Peter Weir pulled it off.
Yes.
Because no one watches that movie then thinks, I want to go to war.
Peter Weir is the greatest director that Australia has ever produced. Like, bar none, hands down. Like, no one else is even in the room.
I think you have covered some really titanic filmmakers and some really titanic films so far, but I truly think what makes Peter Weir special and what makes you doing this one special is we don't talk about Peter Weir that way, and we should. Peter Weir is one of those guys who I don't get why he isn't a bigger name, why he isn't more in that rarefied air, because I think film for film, he's one of our very best filmmakers. He has brought his A game repeatedly to many properties. There are films of his that I hold very dear. Fearless, The Mosquito Coast. I will fight somebody if they talk bad about The Mosquito Coast. It's, man, I love that movie. But in general, I just think he is a special filmmaker, a smart, lyrical, hallucinatory filmmaker. He's a very dreamy filmmaker, and I don't think he gets his due.
You know, Master and Commander is one of my all-time favorite movies. It's easily one of the best movies of the last 20 years. It's a grand scale. There's a historical backdrop to it, but at the same time, there's such an intimacy in the relationships.
Which I think is not just a great film and one of the last great epics in the truest sense. I think is actually kind of a sliding doors change point moment in cinema history. I think 2003, when that comes along, and it is an old-fashioned, you know, we don't make them like that anymore type film. I think if Master and Commander spawns a franchise at that point, the entire cinema landscape globally is completely different.
That's the movie that I wanted to see 10 of those, you know. I know they're big fans of Fast and Furious and everything, and God bless you, but Master and Commander should have been.
It's one of those things. Again, I'm not a seafaring man, sir. But there is a sense of authenticity. There's a sense of really watching a genuine dedication to recreating history unfold on a big screen in front of you that can't help but inspire just genuine admiration and awe.
If you're going to pick a film where he really brings every one of his skills to the table, it's Master and Commander. I think you picked the right one, man.
Yeah, very excited to see what you pull out of this, Blake.
That's right. Our next series is Peter Weir and Russell Crowe's Master and Commander. The series is called Podcaster and Commander.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.